What exactly is the point of an education? Rest assured, I am not asking this from the perspective of, say, a 15-year-old turned off by calculus. I mean, how do we want school to shape people? The traditional way of looking at this was that teachers and professors could transmit knowledge to their students. But there's actually a much better way for them to learn, and if we get it right, it will ensure their minds keep growing long after they've graduated. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Jose Antonio Bowen has served as dean at Miami University and Southern Methodist University and as president of Goucher College. He believes the best educators act as cognitive coaches to their students, encouraging them to change their own minds by experimenting and exploring so that learning is a kind of lifelong process of discovery. His book about this is called Teaching Change: How to Develop Independent Thinkers Using Relationships, Resilience, and Reflection. Jose, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be here.
You say the job of a teacher is to make yourself obsolete. What do you mean by that?
So when you're in school, the teacher is telling you what's true, what's not true, what the right answers are. I mean, I started as a music teacher, and so my job was to say, "Ooh, that needs more practice. That's not quite ready to go on stage." Or, "You know what? That's really ready. Stop beating yourself up. It's ready to go now." And so ultimately, though, I want the student to know what's true for themselves, to know what's relevant, to know how to prioritize, to know this is actually ready to go. I can publish this paper. I can publish this book. I can play this piece. This is good science. So ultimately, that means that as teachers, we want to make ourselves obsolete so the students aren't coming back to us to get another dose of knowledge or another dose of facts or what's true. We really want to teach them process. It's not unlike the adage, do you teach a person to fish or do you give them fish? It's certainly easier to give them fish, and actually people like that better, right? So students always complain when I say, okay, we're going to make you do the work. But as we know from fitness, watching someone else do push-ups is not that useful. Even if they're intellectual push-ups, right? Watching somebody else fish is not going to help you learn as well as doing it yourself. And so ultimately, our role is to help students not only do the push-ups themselves to do the learning, but also understand their own motivation, understand their own process, so they can actually self-regulate their own learning in the future.
There's an argument to be made here that we should have been doing it this way all along. But what is it that you think has changed about the world that makes the old model of just passing down facts and a teacher or professor's assessment of a student's performance, what makes that unhelpful now?
Well, it's still the case. It was always the case, and it's still the case, that content matters, right? There are some things that you do need to learn. You do need to learn that 2 and 2 equals 4. You do need to learn how to communicate effectively. All of those sorts of things are still true. But the balance has shifted. So 100 years ago, where the pace of new knowledge generation was much slower, if you had a body of knowledge when you graduated, you could use that body of knowledge over your entire career. And yes, you would learn new things. But think about, a computer science degree today. That's clearly useful. Students should all learn how to do some coding and some technology. But no matter how good your degree is, it's a degree in the previous iPhone, right? Mm. It's a degree in the iPhone 12 or 11, right? And we're on the 14 before we know it. And so the pace of change has increased. We now know that the jobs of the future are largely unknown, right? That a few years ago, if you had said, students are going to have degrees in social media, so what's that? It doesn't exist. And now you can manage social media, right? You can be a social media manager. So there are all sorts of degrees of jobs that no longer exist. And all of the data tells us that all sorts of things are being automated. There's even a study that says that the degree that's most likely to be useless, or at least to not directly lead to your career, is accounting, followed by finance, which surprises most people. But again, it's professors. Who do we know? It's the future. We haven't been there. But the argument is that right? A lot of artificial intelligence will be able to do the things that accountants currently do, in the same way that TurboTax made it everybody for, you know, you just put in the numbers and it'll read the book for you. So jobs are changing, and that's because of knowledge creation, right? When I went to school, knowledge was scarce but relatively reliable, right? We had this thing called the encyclopedia, right? And so we all knew that encyclopedias were out of date the minute they were published, but it wasn't that bad, right? Yeah. You know, a few years later. And so now knowledge is abundant, but mostly unreliable. So it actually matters a whole lot more to be able to say, is this true or is it not true? Because there is no encyclopedia that keeps you up to date. And I often, actually, what's interesting is that I could not have written this book pre-internet because I was looking at things like, you know, weight loss or how to get people to floss more or vote more, and, you know, research and all sorts of things, you know, mobile health. So I would not have been able to make those connections in a physical library. But Google is actually pretty good at that. I was able to find information about how people change, applied in lots of different ways that really helped me. So the internet was essential. But at the same time, I needed to be much more cognizant of, is this a good source? Is this information reliable? What are the connections? I needed to be responsible for making those connections, for thinking, well, where else could I look, even though the internet made it easier? So learning to change your own mind to self-regulate is vastly more important, even though it was always important. But it's more important for the economy. I call this the learning economy. I think we're no longer in just a knowledge economy, because our devices know more than we do, right? We're confused about what it means to be smart, right? We even call it a smartphone. We're so confused, right? Because it's true. Siri knows more than you do. But we're confused. Students actually think, well, you know, if I know more, I'll be smarter. And school actually reinforces this. I mean, think about, you know, you're all the way through, you know, elementary school through medical school. You're making rounds and somebody says to the doctor, you know, what is that? Oh, there's the answer. It's like, oh, well, I need to know more answers rather than I need to know better questions. I need to know when to. I mean, critical thinking really starts when you start to doubt your own assumptions. And so we want to be less certain of what we know, not more certain, but school sets us up to always be more certain.
Please continue.
I was going to say the other reason is I think clear from where our democracy is at the moment. And I don't know if that's, I mean, I think some of the damage to democracy has been due to that social media and the very things that amplify minority voices. Of course, that's also a good thing. It's given minority voices a bigger voice. But again, it's like when I said when I wrote this book, we now have access to more different opinions, different types of information. But that means that we now need people reading that information to take more responsibility for their own self-regulation, their own ability to understand where can I get reliable information and what is not reliable information. And for people on both sides, social media and divided news networks are not the answer, right? Because even if you're getting information that conforms what you already believe, that's just as bad, right? You're getting confirmation bias. So listening to biased sources of media that are both for your opinion and against your opinion, right? People think, oh, that's a good one. I listen to both sides. No, actually, that's not really that helpful, because your brain is doing too much sorting of information. And so we need to understand the process for how we learn new things and how we change our mind if democracy is really going to function. And we need it now more than we ever did before.
Jose, you stress that it's really important for teachers to be aware of the emotional effect their content has on students, to make clear at the outset that there might be some upsetting things discussed. Where I think the general public tends to misunderstand this is in assuming this means students are encouraged to just excuse themselves and avoid that material altogether. You say it's the duty of teachers to also explain to students the benefit of that kind of stress and discomfort. What are those benefits?
So anyone who's ever had a Thanksgiving argument about politics with a relative knows that facts alone tend not to change minds, and that with relatives, people that you know, but right, once you get emotionally involved, it's very hard then to bring the conversation back to a useful place. So humans were designed to be cooperative and collaborative. So I'm not the first person to emphasize the social characteristics of learning. But what this means is that if you want students to experience discomfort, you first have to get them to experience trust and a sense of safety and belonging, right? Because we are literally wired up, our amygdala at the back of our brain checks all impulses for threat, right? And our fight, flight, or freeze response kicks in before the impulse actually gets to the rational part of our brain, right? So that we see out of the corner of our eye, tiger, and we think, okay, it might be a tiger. So the human beings 10,000 years ago who said, well, wait a second, it's a beautiful thing. Let me just see if it's, oh, no, they got eaten. They're dead. You didn't get their genes, right? So your brain says, even if it's maybe, possibly a tiger, run up the tree. And if it turns out it's not a tiger, you lose very little, right? The consequences are little. But if it is a tiger and you don't run, then the consequences are death. So we are like a smoke detector, right? Your brain actually works just like a smoke detector, right? You want your smoke detector to be a little bit overly sensitive, right? Because if it gets it wrong and the smoke detector goes off, okay, the worst thing that happens is you have that annoying beep, you're frying something too much, okay, you turn it off. But if the smoke detector works the other way and not sensitive enough, then the house burns down. So turns out this is also true for ideas, right? So an idea can also be threatening. Now, people don't think they're this way, but in fact, it's the way we're wired to work, is that, and again, it's just like the maybe it's a panther. Maybe this idea is threatening. And I think, well, okay. And then immediately the blood is now flowing to my legs, right? It's hard to think when the blood is all flowing away from your brain. But the minute I don't feel welcome in your classroom or I feel scared. So like a common trigger is math, right? If students who had a bad math experience in high school, they think they can't do math. They hear the word math. They know, they hear there's going to be math. And immediately they are confirmed in this belief because their brain shuts off and the blood flows to their legs. They want to freeze or run. So the first thing teachers have to do is help students understand that they can succeed, that the teacher cares about them, and that they belong in the classroom. Again, this is really not a revolution, but the data is pretty strong that the perception that teachers care dramatically changes how much and what you learn. And so, you know, learning students' names, simple things, you know, standing at the door saying, I believe in you, listening to students and their complaint, you know, those thinking about students first and when, where they start. I'm a big fan of the pre-class survey, where I want students to tell me what they know about my subject. But more than that, I want them to tell me who they are and how they learn best, what they think is important. And that accomplishes two things, right? So the question that's great for teachers to ask is, tell me what inspires you to do your best work. What are the conditions where you do your best work? Students are much more likely to answer that question than the, you know, tell me what you know about my subject, which is my second question. But the first question shows that I'm interested in you. And so I learn a whole lot about what students think of as learning, think of how they learn, and then also what they think about my subject. But if I want you to be uncomfortable, I have to start with making you feel comfortable, right? You know, it's if home base isn't safe, you're not going to steal, right? You're not going to, or, you know, in the gym analogy is, right? A lot of this, you know, the cognitive coaches metaphor comes right out of my experience in, you know, gym or yoga class, where, right, they break things up. They go, let's just do 3 more push-ups. Oh, okay, let's do 5 more. You know, it's 5, 6. Oh, no, let's do 8 more. You know, if you told me it was going to be 100 sit-ups, I would have given up long ago, right? So I have to trust that you'll know when I've got to the breaking point and you're going to stop me, or you're going to say, let's take a break. But ultimately, I have to feel like you get me and you, right, you're motivating me, because it is about human motivation.
Let's talk about group discussion, which I think has been a treasured tool in particularly high school and college classrooms. Are there reasons to reevaluate how it works and the ways it can go wrong?
So think about what Homo sapiens were doing 10,000 years ago as we were evolving the brains that we now have, right? We evolved to be cooperative. It's why we feel loneliness, right? Because if you didn't feel loneliness, then you would have wandered off by yourself, and then the group would have wandered away, and you're just like, oh, wait, I'm hungry now, but I can't hunt mammoth by myself. Where did everybody go, right? So if you're isolated, we feel lonely, and we want to go back and rejoin the group. But it also means that, right, if we're going to be effective hunting mammoth, right, we weren't the smartest or the fastest or the strongest creatures on the planet, but we were the most cooperative. But cooperation relies on listening to the leader, listening to somebody else say, okay, so you're going to stand over there, you're going to throw the spear, you're going to jump out of the trees, we're going to chase the beast, right? And so, okay, I'm going to do that. And if I say, I think I have a better way, I'm not, right? It's like, well, now we're all going to starve. So we are designed to be cooperative, but that also means we're conformists. It also, on the good side, means we're shallow experts, right? We know a little about a lot, and a lot about a little, right? That's how we can send someone to the moon or build an iPhone, because we don't have to do all of the things ourselves. We can be experts in one part. But that same advantage that allows us to build the iPhone also means that we're conformists. So we pay way too much attention to who is speaking, right? The taller presidential candidate tends to win. In the average population, about 14% of people are above 6 feet tall, but 56% of CEOs in Fortune 500 companies are over 6 feet tall, right? So we like tall leaders. We listen to tall people. We like people who smile in the same cultural way, right? So Asians smile in a different way, have different, right? Not, they don't show as many teeth. They are distrustful of Westerners who show too many teeth, right? So we evaluate people in all these funny ways. Before they've said anything, right? So we're looking at, ooh, I want to be on the lacrosse team. He's on the lacrosse team. I bet you what he's saying is true. And none of this happens in our conscious, rational minds, right? This is all happening in the background, because human beings, right, we get millions of pieces of information every minute, millions and millions more than we can process. We can evaluate a few dozen a minute. So we discard most of it. Kind of like what you do with your email, right? You discard most of it, right? But the bit that says, here's a story about Chris Boyd, ooh, you slow down and you read that one, right? but the other stuff we delete. So what you want for students is, I need to figure out, what is it that you're going to pay attention to? And notice, right, the first word of that pay attention is pay, right? It costs something. There is a price to be paid for cognitive load, for attention. And so what your brain does is it says, well, who is speaking? And so lawyers know this because juries do this, right? If you go into the jury room, the first person who speaks has most of the power. Because if you're sitting there going, I think he's not guilty, but the first person who speaks says, oh, that guy is guilty, you immediately start to doubt yourself. But if that first person who speaks says, not guilty, you think, oh, yes, that's exactly what I thought. And now I feel more confident. And it turns out it's going to be harder to change your mind. So juries actually do something, or are instructed to do something, that teachers, and we now know educationally, makes a lot of sense, which is, don't ask students, well, what do you think? Say, let's do a poll. Let's do an anonymous silent poll and see, oh, half of you think he's guilty, half of you think he's not guilty. Half of you thought the book had a fatal flaw, half of you thought it was really right on. Or have students write position papers. But it turns out that the first thing that happens in class is that students are looking at the other students and thinking, what do they think? Who do I admire? Who do I want to be like? Which social group do I want to be a part of? So it turns out that our identity precedes thinking, right? Who we think we are determines who we listen to and how we think, which is part of why, right, news and social media are so hard, because we're so predisposed to think, well, is this person somebody reliable? Is it somebody I trust? All of those things are going on in the background. So if you really want to get students to change your mind, you have to recognize that the fundamental question in a classroom is, if I'm going to change my mind, will I have to change my friends' minds? Will my friends like me? Do I have to change my friends? Will my friends think I'm a pariah now? So turns out that humans don't actually think alone. We think in groups, and this is often a very good thing, but it's very problematic if we rely too much on discussion in the classroom without recognizing that we have to structure that classroom in ways that work against our natural social biases.
So many young adults now arrive at college after 12 years of being told that the stakes for every assignment, every paper, every extracurricular activity are so high that a single failure could be catastrophic. Many of those students as undergraduates want to get into a good grad school. How can professors help students build back some tolerance for failure?
Yeah, so the world's best teacher is a tennis net, because it gives immediate feedback that's non-judgmental and you can try again. So sometimes you need a coach standing by the side telling you, you know, move your feet, move your arms, hold the racket a different way. But sometimes you just need more balls. You just need more practice. And so, you know, it's often said that we learn more from failure than we do from success. And so there's a lot of work done in the last 20 years by Carol Dweck at Stanford on mindset and having a growth mindset, which is really about how you think about failure. That if you think failure is an opportunity to learn more, you're going to be more successful in life. Those people make more money. They have more successful lives in every way. But if you think that intelligence is fixed, then you think, oh my gosh, I made a mistake. I must have less of that intelligence thing that I thought of. So it actually turns out to be true that if you think you can make yourself smarter, you can. And if you think that intelligence is fixed, then it turns out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if what we really want to do as teachers is release potential to help students find their own voice and for students to become lifelong learners, then we have to spend more time on process and not just content. We have to spend more time on the idea that what is going on in your head when you learn something? Are you able to self-regulate? Do you recognize that process? And so that's why I talk about relationships, resilience, and reflection, because those are the three pieces that everybody needs to be able to learn new things and to change.
Is there some way to decouple that kind of feedback and assessment from grades, which, I mean, are meant to be a reflection of how well a student has mastered the course materials, but in practice feel like a very different thing to a lot of students?
So first, it's really important to recognize that feedback and grades are two entirely different things. Hmm. There is, in fact, a national movement called ungrading. There are lots of people who are doing contract grading or other kinds of things. But yeah, the truth is that a lot of us are going to be forced to give grades either because students want them to get into medical school or the school requires them. And the truth is, by the time they've been through 12 years of school, they get to college, they know how grades work. If you just take grades away, they go, well, how am I doing? But it turns out that the tennis net analogy works here again, that feedback is really important. So one of the things I talk about in the book, I've talked about previously, are what are called cognitive wrappers, or about separating feedback from grades. Because what teachers do is, right, you hand back a paper, you spent, you know, all this time writing notes on it, and the student then looks at the grade, their amygdala goes off, they get an emotional reaction, and they stuff the paper in their backpack and they march out the door and they never read all of your feedback. So teachers do a couple things wrong. One is we give too much feedback, right? You don't need a coach who says, move your feet, move your hands, hold the racket. It's like, no, one thing at a time, right? So just talk to me about sentence structure or just talk to me about paragraphs, but not the whole thing. And two, we need to create time for reflection in the classroom. And so the way that you do that is that you save the last 5 or 10 minutes of class, and then you hand back the problem set or the assignment without a grade on it. It doesn't mean it hasn't been graded, but technology now allows us to put the grades in some learning management system online and then hide them. And so you say to students, here is your paper and here is my feedback. Please read the feedback, but I also give them a little structure to that. So I want you to now reflect. So what grade did you want? Where do you think you lost points, right? Read the feedback and try to estimate, ooh, I didn't do well on this. And then what would you change next time in to have a better result? What would you do, right? I'm giving you the opportunity to think about your own learning and how you could self-regulate your own learning and change. And so this idea initially was tried in STEM, but we actually tried it when I was at SMU, for opera auditions, right? A very, very different field. because we were aware that what happens when you give students the results of their audition? It's like, well, you didn't get the part. And they say, you hate me. It's like, no. So instead of telling, so the first thing we do is, okay, I'm not going to tell you yet if you got the part or not. Those results are out on the door. They're someplace in cyberspace. I want you to reflect on, how did your audition go? What could you have done better? And the students, well, you know, I did forget my words, and next time I should probably make sure I remember the lyrics. It's like, yeah, okay, and that's why you didn't get the part, right? So, but if the student had, so right, but I've gone around the amygdala, both with that relationship sense of belonging, but also with providing you the opportunity to reflect without a grade. So again, back to tennis, right? Having somebody standing next to you going A+, B-, C. That's not really help. The net is giving you all the feedback you need, right? If it's not going over the net, so can we design systems? And that's, education is really a design problem, just like the gym is, right? Can I design systems where students will be motivated to hit a few more balls? That's really what we're trying to do.
All right. How do you get educators to be flexible enough to reflect back on what might be years or even decades of teaching in a different way, and acknowledge that some of this might work better for their students?
Well, I actually think that teachers are not the problem. I think teachers intuitively know this, and teachers want to. Right? If you ask teachers what they do, right, they help students how to think. I help students how to find their own voice. But mostly what teachers complain about is, well, you know, I have to prepare them for this standardized test, or there's all this content. You know, this happens in college too. It's like, I'm teaching Econ 101. Oh, but if I don't teach them that, the person teaching Econ 102 will be really unhappy. And so we think that we're covering content, or we're forced to make sure that we cover a list of topics. In fact, most of us in school, you know, that what we learned about teaching was by watching other teachers. And I have to remind teachers that we're weird, right? We like school so much, we're still here. And that's not normal. And in fact, it's exactly like that feeling that teachers get when we go to the gym and we see that fitness coach with the giant muscles. And we think, oh, that person is so, they do push-ups on their own. They're weird, right? They think push-ups are fun. And that's what students think when they look at us. They think, wow, you go to the library all by yourself with nobody forcing you. That's weird. You're still here. You like school. You feel comfortable here. So for teachers, our experience in school is often that it worked, right? Somebody gave us some content and we went, wow, my world has changed. But for most students, that's not the case. So teachers want to be effective. And most of us started teaching long before we knew anything about all of this cognitive science, right? We just didn't understand as much about the brain or how learning works. You know, this old idea about that there are learning styles. Well, we thought that was true for a long time. Turns out it's not, right? New research proved it's not. So now as teachers, we've got to say, well, how does learning actually work? And it turns out that relationships are the thing that are fundamental. And I start the relationships chapter with this story from a Scandinavian, you know, cardio science journal. Again, I would never have done this without the internet. But doctors were dealing with patients, patients have had a heart attack. And the doctor says, you are going to die. You had a heart attack. You're going to die unless you can change your behavior in these four ways. Can you eat less salt, drink more fluid, exercise a little, and weigh yourself daily, right? That's the feedback. Weigh yourself daily is like hitting them a few more balls with a tennis net. So the percentage of people that can do all four of those things after a heart attack is only 7%. So 93% of people can't do it, even when the doctor says, this is really serious. So information doesn't change how you think. But here's the kicker in this study. What was the largest predictor for change? What determined who was in the 7% who could make those four changes, eat less salt, drink more fluid? And who was in the 93%? The biggest predictor of change was loneliness. So if nobody comes to visit you and you don't have a wedding to look forward to, no grandchildren, why should I change? So relationships are the primary motivator for getting people to say, I need to be invested. I need to pay attention. I need to be a part of this.
And
And
we
I
will
think as
need to
teachers, we
leave
like
it.
that.
We will need to leave it there. Jose Antonio Bowen has served as dean of Miami University and SMU, and is president of Goucher College. His book is called "Teaching Change: How to Develop Independent Thinkers Using Relationships, Resilience, and Reflection." Jose, thanks very much for making time to talk with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.